Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Seth Perler again with TFOS, the Executive Function Online Summit 2019, and I'm here with Adrienne Meldrum, and I've known Adrienne for a long time, and so we were just doing a little pre-interview and chatting. She's going to talk today about math and executive function, particularly something that she's been involved with for a long time called multisensory math. And if you've watched some of the other speakers who've talked about sensory issues, this is going to be really powerful for you. And if you haven't, this is going to be really powerful for you. So hi, Adrienne.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Good to have you here. I'm really excited to dive into this. We've known each other a long time, and we've really, I don't know how many years, but do you want to tell them how we got to know each other? I think you were taking
Yeah, it's a little bit of a stalker story, actually. a few years back, my oldest was in middle school, and I'm sure lots of you can relate to this. Middle school was rough, and he was failing a lot of classes. And in sixth grade, he avoided summer school because that was the rule. You couldn't do summer school as a sixth grader, but he probably should have. And then seventh grade came, and we were having the same problems over and over and over. And I was just so frustrated because this is, you know, I'm a tutor, I'm a math person. You would think I could figure out my own kid. I could not figure it out. And then I found Seth online, and I just, like, joined your list. I started hitting reply to every message you sent. and it was towards the end of the year. He was going to have to do summer school. I was panicking, and you had sent this crazy message out. It was something like, if you'll donate to Pencils of Promise, I'll do a free session with you or something. And I replied immediately, and I paid, I donated, sent you my receipt, and your response, I'll never forget it, one line was, well, clearly you don't have executive function problems. And so we met, and you helped me rescue my son from the summer school experience. And he went from an F to, I think, a C+, like, overnight. And just doing your method, it was like coming out of the dip really quickly. So that was how our relationship began. And we just, because we both care about kids and we both work in the same circles, we've just connected and stayed in contact. And my son has taken Seth's classes. So if you're a parent or an educator, like, I highly recommend them because my son doesn't struggle with those things anymore. We don't do summer school anymore. He's doing well. He's happy. So, and that's all because Seth taught him about his brain and how to honor where he's at and be happy and, you know, and find what you're passionate about. It was really pivotal for us.
Awesome. Yeah. And that's the whole point here with this whole summit is how do we take parents from point A's to point B's, meaning like different experts have different point A and point B, and we'll dive into yours today. But yeah, we're trying to help people create change. So tell the people watching, before we get into the meat of the session, tell them a little bit about who you are outside of work.
Yeah, outside of work. Well, so I'm a mom to three boys, 15.
And you just threatened one not to come in.
I did. I threatened my youngest. He's not allowed to come in here. He's not allowed to use the bathroom this next door, like, none of that. And they're getting used to that there. But sometimes they don't obey. Sometimes they still pop in. So I apologize ahead of time if that happens.
If somebody pops through the door.
If someone pops through the door. So I have a 15, a 13, and a 10-year-old, but they're all boys. And my oldest has executive function issues, and my youngest does too. My middle son, not so much. He's highly driven and can take care of things on his own. So it makes it interesting here at our house because everyone's needs and issues are slightly different, as much as their strengths are different. But so I'm a mom, and I'm married to Dave, who's an engineer. As a family, we geek out about engineering stuff. For fun fact, my oldest and I went across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge this summer, and we paid the toll just because we wanted to drive on this really cool bridge that climbs up and then crawls along the bay. Little did I know that, like, locals were horrified by that. They think that bridge is really scary and rickety, but we were like, it was fine. That was a really cool bridge. So we're into that kind of stuff. We like cool buildings, cool bridges, you know, that fun stuff. And when I'm not working and not hanging with my kids, I'm always down at the Boise River. I live in Boise, Idaho. It's like my favorite place. It's beautiful. We have a really long green belt. I think it's over 20 miles long at this point. So it's really beautiful down there. Lots of trees, lots of water, lots of nature. And that is seriously my happy place. So when I got done traveling this summer, that was the first place I wanted to go. Let's go check in at the river, see how it's doing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so those are the things about me. Hobbies. I love making video. I know that sounds weird, but I think it's because of how my brain's wired. Writing's hard for me. And I like making video because it's a way for me to visually tell a story, tell a dialogue. So that is my happy place, is making videos to express myself.
Cool. And then professionally, tell us about your background.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been tutoring math for a really long time. A few years back, I started getting involved with multisensory math because there was always these few kids that just nothing that I knew how to do traditionally would reach them. So that never sits well with me. I'm a problem solver by nature. So I would start on this journey of figuring out what's going on. And I found multisensory math, which means we're working through these three steps, from concrete, meaning things we can touch, to representational images, to the abstract, which is numbers. And these kids at school, all they do is the abstract. And so they never get to really experience math in this other way, this other sensory experience. And so when we do, it's amazing what they can do, how quickly we can move them up a couple grade levels. Most of the students we work with are 2 to 4 grade levels behind. And so we have a lot of work to do when they show up, but connecting back into the concrete really helps them excel forward and do better.
And for those of you parents who are going, what did she just say? Don't worry, we will get to that. And we'll explain how you can take this information and apply some of it in your situation. So cool. Let's see what we got here. And why does this matter to you? How did you get into working with kids who struggle with math?
Yeah, it's crazy. I kind of stumbled into it at first. More or less because I had graduated from school, did a little bit of teaching, and then I had my oldest, and I was telling my sister, you know, while I love being a mom, I feel like my brain's dripping out of the side of my ears. Like, it's just, I need something more to do. I'm not very good at just like doing one thing at a time. I like to do lots of things. So she's like, well, use your degree. Clearly you should be a tutor. So that's what I started doing. And truth be told, I was actually terrified at first because math was hard for me growing up. And again, I think it's because all of my teachers spent time doing the abstract and procedures that way. So I was nervous about the tutoring, but turns out I have a knack for breaking it down simply. When I was a 7th grader, I'll go back to this story really quick. When I was a 7th grader, I got placed in a remedial math class. And that was
a note here because I want to ask you something, but go ahead.
Yeah. So I was, you know, really devastated by that, but too shy, number one, to say anything to anyone. I didn't say anything to my mom that I was embarrassed by that. And the reason why that happened is several years of school, math facts were hard for me to learn, which you'll learn why later. That's hard for me. And it just all kind of compounded up to 7th grade when they did the placement test. And it turns out I needed to basically repeat 6th grade math. So I was devastated, but it turned out to be the best thing for me because I had a teacher who saw what was going on with me. I felt invisible, and I bet a lot of your kids can relate to that. I bet maybe some of you can relate to that. You felt invisible at school. We always sat alphabetically. I always had to sit in the back with these rowdy boys that I've been sitting with my whole life. And he saw me and was like, hey, why don't you come up here and sit by me up at the front? He put me right in the front row. And I think most kids would maybe be a little bothered by that, but I wasn't. I was like, wow, he saw me, you know, after years of not being seen, he actually sees me. So I sat down at the front. It turns out I needed to be closer to proximity. And the nice thing is he could walk by and tap my notepaper and say, think about this, or he would quickly write something on my paper instead of, you know, me sitting in the back missing all of that. So it started opening up my mind to maybe I can figure this out. And it turns out I did. I figured it out. I learned the math that year. And then I always was an A student after that. But it was hard. I have to say it was hard. It was not easy for me.
Well, your brain was working hard on that at that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
To fill in some gaps.
To fill in those gaps. Yes. Yes. And I would say it wasn't until I was tutoring kids and teaching that I completely understood it much at a much deeper level. So I'm grateful.
The best way to learn anything is by teaching it. And
Yeah, absolutely. So I had an interesting experience a few years ago. There was a moment in time where I thought, maybe I'm in the wrong place. Maybe I'm doing the wrong work, you know, because it's hard to work with kids.
You and I have had this talk a lot.
We've had this talk. It's emotionally draining. It's taxing. It takes up a lot of time. And I thought, maybe I'm in the wrong place or whatever. But I was at a conference and I heard Tony Robbins talk about, if you don't love the people you're serving, no matter what business you do, you'll never be happy. And so I went back to my hotel room and really thought about that. And I found this common thread between everything I was doing, from tutoring kids to making videos to, I think at that point I was helping you with your course, because I have really a lot of skill sets. But there's this common thread that I found. Turns out that I'm all about those kids that used to be me, that feel unseen, unloved, neglected, stupid, all the things that they're being told, lazy, unmotivated. Turns out I'm all about them. And I would say no to projects without realizing it, because it didn't serve that inner purpose. So I have a huge desire to see these kids, make sure they are feeling loved and validated and appreciated for their awesome brain, because they all have amazing brains capable of great things.
And what the note that I was taking is wounded healers, that you really became what you needed. And so many of the speakers are and experts on the summit are that, myself included. I help kids who are struggling in school and feel bad about themselves, particularly around executive function. You're doing what you're, so you're one of the wounded healers also.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? And I think
I love it. I think it's the coolest thing when somebody can use what they thought was a challenge, and like their relationship with the thing, in your case, math, was, you know, I'm not good at this, blah, blah. And to be able to change that and use that to serve humanity, I think is super cool.
Absolutely. And it really, once I was able to condense it down to, this is my why, now I'm much more willing to do stuff that scares me. So for some of your presenters, like coming and doing this with you may have been totally scary for them. But again, because they understood their why, they're willing to do something like this. So for on the horizon for me this next year, I'm going to go be a presenter on stages, because I care that much about these kids. It's not really about the adults in the room. It's about the kids that they serve. And so that's why I'm there. And so I have to focus on that, because I could really freak myself out and tell myself all kinds of garbage stories that are not true. And so having a why is huge, huge.
So I have another question, but I'm going to wait till a little bit later, but it's related to your experience. I'll tell you what it is now, but I think it'll be better to address later and you'll know when it fits in. But what it is basically that you, I guess when you were talking, what was going on in my visual mind is that you were saying that in math, it was as if you have like a 3-story house, and they were like imagining that you had the bottom 2 stories and they're teaching you as if you're on the 3rd story and you didn't have these 2 foundational stories below it. And you, the top one is, I think was
abstract.
More abstract, but there are these 2 ones below it. And you're really, and helping kids who are missing those, they have gaps or holes in the bucket in those lower stories. And once you started piecing that together and really seeing that, you're really able to help these kids build that so that they can get to that abstract place.
Exactly. Yeah.
And what I imagine is that a lot of kids who seem naturally good at math, they actually did build those foundations, even though it wasn't maybe formally taught. They were sitting in the same classroom as everybody else, but somehow they were able to fill in those gaps, but some kids can't do that through osmosis. And that's who you serve. Is that a good way to describe
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Want to revisit that later or
no? Yeah, I'd be fine visiting it later. But I mean, you said a phrase like my visual thinker brain, blah, blah, blah. That's who my students are. They're the visual thinkers. When we do an assessment, we do this really in-depth one. It maps the neural pathways that they use for solving math. Almost every student maxes out their visual spatial capability. And that never surprises me because that's why they're here. They need this method. And that's why like regular tutoring isn't going to work because it's just more of the same stuff they're getting at school. They need that concrete stuff. They need to explain differently, different language, different imagery, different experience altogether.
Awesome. So before we get into all of that, let's talk about your definition of executive function.
Yeah. So I was thinking about
that. Watching today, who literally this is brand new to them.
Yeah.
Like, okay, this is a thing. And they're watching your talk and they've never heard of it until maybe this weekend. What's executive function? Unpack it a little bit for us.
Okay. Yeah. So I believe it's the kids' ability to use their working memory, become a flexible thinker, and use self-control to allow them to get things done from math to a project.
For the person who's watching who's never heard of working memory.
Yeah.
And
yes, so I was going to explain what working memory is. I think everyone knows what flexible thinking is. I think everyone kind of knows what self-control is. But working memory is that part of your brain that holds a piece of information and can manipulate it. So this is hard for some of our kids. They have a working memory issue. And so like a math fact, trying to hold a math fact in their head and use it can be really difficult. But we're using them as adults. Working memory develops over time. And so it's not that they're never going to be able to do it. It's just going to develop slower. And with the right support, it will get stronger. So working memory is all about holding information, using and manipulating it. It's when you go to the grocery store, if someone gives you more than two items to remember to get, you're probably going to struggle to remember that third one or maybe the fourth one. In my family, we have enough kids with working memory issues. We send a text. Here's what you need. Here's a list. Take it with you.
And when you were talking earlier, I took a couple notes and I said, I'm going to write this down because I knew that I wanted my executive function, which I do struggle with, but I knew that I wanted it to use my reserves to focus on you. So I jotted those things down so it didn't have to, I didn't have to depend on my working memory for that.
Exactly. Right? So, yes. Yes.
And that's a big part of executive function, as you're saying.
Yeah. Huge, huge part. As far as like the math piece of executive function, the flexible thinking, that's huge for math. Some of our kids are so rigid. So we do specific games and things with our students to encourage that flexible thinking. And we'll talk about that more in depth and later. But self-control goes to controlling your emotions, keeping them in check. And a lot of that in math is learning how to deal with failure and the feelings that go along with it.
Yeah, like you said, at that one point you were working, it was really hard. So you're dealing with something that's not necessarily fun. It's very challenging. You're working.
Mm-hmm.
Your brain is working, but that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So that's how I kind of view executive function. Now, if I think about all the processes involved in turning in a math homework assignment, I counted once, there's about 12 involved. And we have to give our kids some grace. I mean, if they skip one or two of those, it all falls apart and it doesn't get turned in or they don't get credit or whatever because they missed one little piece of that. That's a lot of steps.
I'm really glad you said that because we sort of have executive function. The speakers are coming from different perspectives, but one big perspective is sort of the tactical, how do we get things done, like doing and turning into homework.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is when we're actually doing the homework, the mental processes that are taking place with executive function to do the homework, and in this case, math, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's real quick, since a lot of the rest of the conference is about the tactical, but I do want to hear just a little bit about what you were saying about the 12 steps of turning in homework or something. Can you just run through a couple of those so that people have a better idea of executive function in those sorts of ways?
Well, so you mentioned the tactical. So a lot of the first few steps, I'm thinking like they have to have sustained attention to even write down what the homework assignment was. Or if a worksheet was given to them, remember to put it in their backpack or their binder. That's going to be difficult. So there's a tactical piece. Once that homework gets home, then we have to rely on the child's memory to, oh yeah, I have homework. I should pull that out and do that. Then they have to recall back in the day when the teacher taught this, and pull that information forward, hold it in their working memory, and work on it in their homework. And these kids tend to, a lot of them can see relationships very easily. So they tend to like speed ahead and like just, you know, write. But what they fail to do is keep track of the steps that are needed to solve, the process, the procedure that's required. And you know how math is. I mean, they love to lay traps in the worksheet, right? And so they miss really important key relationships that they couldn't see or they thought they saw, but then they write down the wrong thing. And so they're going to get it marked wrong. And then they're going to get frustrated because it gets marked wrong. But there's all of that piece. And then let alone, then we're back to the tactical of remembering to put that homework in the backpack. Hopefully it has a name at the top and turn it in. I can't tell you how many of my students say, gosh, I haven't seen a grade show up for that homework assignment. It's probably in the no-name bin. It probably is. Mm-hmm. So the executive function piece, I think the hardest part for math is keeping track of how do we do this assignment? What do I need to do to show credit that I understand what's happening? That's probably the most draining. But then all those ancillary tactile of how to get it turned in is exhausting too. So if I was to break it down even more, it's probably more like 25 steps.
So there's all, and those are for everybody watching, those are all executive function things, more on this, just the process of doing an assignment. There are many, many executive function things that take place just to get the assignment, from getting it to getting it in with your name on it. Like there are many things that happen. So, and then when we're looking at math in particular, you were talking about a few. Do you want to go into some of those key executive function areas that are used when doing math?
Sure.
So let's start with how those areas look and really focus on how parents can identify when their kid is struggling with those areas.
Okay. So I think the biggest one, this is the easiest one to identify, the working memory issue. So we're going to talk about math facts because that's something every parent can easily identify. My kid struggles with it. So here's why. So in the brain, Joe Bowler from Stanford University proved that this is true with her research. The addition and subtraction facts are held in the mathematical part of the brain. That's where it's
processed. Subtraction facts?
Addition and subtraction math facts. So the basics, you know, 1 plus 1, 2 minus 3, that kind of stuff. So that's where that's held. But as soon as we move over to multiplication and division, it moves over into the working memory part of the brain, which is fascinating.
Okay, so I'm sorry, I haven't heard this or thought about this in a long time. So there's a part of the brain that deals more with very, very base addition and subtraction facts that are more memorized?
Not memorized, but they're easier to calculate. So the brain can identify quantity really quickly up to 3 and 4. This is why phone numbers have 3 and 4 digits, because the brain can hold on to that.
Groups of 3 digits.
And 4 digits. Okay. Babies can recognize quantities of 3 really easily, 4. But anything above that, we have to put in a pattern in order for the brain to manipulate it. And so the part of the brain that does that is the mathematical part of the brain. And that's a power that we use. We have to teach that to some of our kids, because even maybe that part might be weak. So that part's not too bad, the adding, subtracting, basic number sense. Then when we get over to multiplication, division, it moves over into the working memory part of the brain. And it's more complex because we're doing repeated addition at this point, right? The numbers are bigger.
Repeated addition, for those who don't remember, mm-hmm.
And so the brain's trying to hold on to these bigger numbers. And so it's harder for your child to pull that information out because it has to be more memorized. And if math facts, which most classrooms, this is the truth, it's just flashcards, kill and drill, that's not going to work for your kid. They can't do it. What they need instead is a visual source to pull from to remember that math fact. They also need strategy to help them. So if your child, this was true for my kiddos and true for a lot of my students, if your child struggled with remembering names of objects or they mixed up even the names of objects, my favorite story is my youngest, Trey. When he was little, he would say, Mom, I want some nuggets. I want to go to that place. You know, it's got the Blue Arches like this. And he could not remember McDonald's. And I'd say, you want McDonald's? Yeah. So we'd go to McDonald's. Then he'd tell me, I want a McChicken. Okay, great. And I order him a McChicken, which is a sandwich. And he bawls and starts crying. And I said, what's going on? I thought you wanted McChicken. No, I want that. And he's pointing at his brother who has McNuggets. So to him, the words were way too similar, right? It didn't make sense. And another example of that on his birthday was he told me all about this cake he wanted. I thought I understood. I made the cake. But again, because he couldn't access that language in his working memory and pull out the correct associations, the cake was all wrong in his mind and he refused to eat it on his birthday. And so I knew math facts were going to be hard for him. And they are. It's not that he can't do it. He can with the right strategies. And it takes more time. His processing speed takes a little longer. And at school in third grade, this is solidified with that repetitious timed math facts. Now kids make this association. Oh, I'm only good with math, a good mathematician if I'm fast at it and I always get the right answer. Mm-hmm. That's the furthest thing from the truth. It's not true at all. And it's frustrating because by the time they make it to me, they have all these stories going on in their heads about I'm not smart, I'm not fast, and they think that that's what it takes to be good at math, and that's just not true.
Awesome. I'm really glad you said that. And let's talk age because I think it's relevant right now. What age do we usually see kids starting to move from that part to that part when they start to move into multiplication and division? And then what age do kids usually come to you at? Is there a difference and why?
Yeah. So around age 8, 9, they're going to start learning those multiplication facts at school. And that's when the issues will start showing up. You'll see that it depends on the teacher too. Some teachers like to use that ice cream program where they earn scoops of ice cream, and that is traumatic. I can't tell you how many kids come to me with wounding from the past from that program. It's frustrating. They earn a scoop for every math fact family they learn, and our kids can't do it. They can only memorize maybe one or two. It's a long-term game. I want to tell parents that too. It can take 2, 3, 4 years to memorize them. Yeah. And if we give a kid a calculator as an accommodation, bad idea, because now they're not using them and they disappear. The brain will delete them. So
bad idea all the time or
when they're like 8th grade and under, bad idea, bad idea. Let's wait until the math gets more complex. Let's not use the calculator to do 2 plus 4. That's a waste of your brain. But kids don't come to us until 6th, 7th grade. And often I think parents hear a lot from teachers, he'll get it. He's a late bloomer. He's this, he's that. The truth is if you're seeing these problems in those younger kids, it's better to start getting the help now because this is the foundation. This is what we're building. They need these skills to do well in the higher levels of math. Math is a linear subject. It's built upon itself. And the skills that you see in kindergarten, one that I'll share is called one-to-one correspondence. So this is a kid pointing and counting. That skill is found in high school. Graphing is a one-to-one correspondence task. And we have kids who can't do it. Their pencils hovering on the graph. They're not really sure how to land. And once they start landing and counting, they're usually wrong, because they don't have one-to-one correspondence. So that's how important these skills are that kids are learning when they're little.
Math is one of the most interesting subjects. Like when people say, like our kid has a summer reading list, or they say our kid's supposed to journal over the summer, or should there be year-round schools, and you start having these discussions. Math is the one. I mean, I think there's definitely value in reading and writing over the summer and learning and stuff. But math is really the one that, to me, seems to, because I taught for 12 years, that's the one where you have a kid end a school year at a certain point, start a school year, and they've, quote, lost so much in that time. Like, the practice is so important. But especially for the kiddos, and I talk about bucket theory with math a lot, that it's like a bucket with a bunch of holes. Yeah. The kids that you're talking about, they're starting in kindergarten and there's maybe a tiny hole. And by the time they're in 12th grade, that hole that from back then added with tons of other ones throughout the years means he's trying to fill up his math bucket and learn math stuff, and it's pouring out. And they can look like they're not good at math, like you said. Yeah. And that doesn't mean that they're not good at math. And then I guess I want you to respond to that, and then I want you to respond to one other very common thing that I think parents see.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, unfortunately, in our society, everyone's expected to learn how to read, right? And if you can't read, people are shocked. Like, what? You can't read? You know, that's an expectation. However, as an adult, if you say, I can't balance my checkbook, you get a lot of nods. Yeah, me neither. right? So as a society, we have embraced that it's okay to be bad at math. But the reality is math is used for so many things. I mean, that's what employers are looking for. You need the basics of at least up to algebra one to be able to do most jobs these days. And even though you could argue with me, oh, I'm not using algebra at work, the truth is you probably are, you just don't even realize it. So my argument is, yes, I love what you brought up. Like, we should be doing stuff in the summer with our kids around math. And I make my kids do so. Because again, they lose a lot. You know, that's why teachers have to spend the first few weeks of school reviewing what last year's content was, because they can't move forward. The kids don't remember it. So, and then again, like you said, with the bucket, if they have some holes in their foundation, it's not sticking in, it just keeps draining out. So it's important to get the right kind of support for these kids so that we can start plugging those holes.
Yep. Yep. And it works. You and I both have seen this, that when we do that. So one of the things I want to reiterate to those of you watching from something Adrian said a little bit ago, but I think it's really important, is that in math in particular, I mean, you do this in other subjects too, but when you start seeing those red flags, get help now. Math is one of those things. So I work with middle, high school, and college most of the time. Most of my kids nowadays that I work with are middle, high school, and college. And like you, you start seeing them in middle school generally, right?
Yeah, generally.
Mm-hmm. And I see these kids with so many holes in the bucket, and then they start a new school year, and then they wait until everything has fallen apart to get the tutor. If your kid struggled a little bit last year, I would rather see you start from day one and get a tutor for a month at the beginning of school and maybe not even need it for the rest because they've got a more solid foundation. Then wait till you have even more holes in the bucket with a new teacher, new instructional style, all this stuff. Like, start with somebody who's going to help solidify. And I like the metaphor, solidify and plugging the holes, to solidify with that. Like, start now. Do not wait on math.
Exactly. I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's a common issue. We have a lot of parents that like want to do it. They want to use us, but they always resort to let's wait and see. Let's wait and see. And while I would love to believe that everyone's going to get a Mr. King like me, that is a rare unicorn kind of situation. Mm-hmm. Okay. That is, and you also have to take in consideration your kid's personality. I was ready. I was ripe. I was ready to be picked up and in that headspace. Some kids aren't there. Some are so beaten down by the math. Yeah. They're not in a place they can even see the wonderful unicorn teacher in front of them.
Yeah. And if those kids too, if you say to them, you know, hey, let's start out with a tutor now at the or let me tutor you. And they're not going to want your help, parents, a lot of times. Yeah. But at the beginning of the school year, they're going to be resistant. You mean I got to go to class every day in math and I have to do more math with a tutor? But work with that problem. Yes, they're going to resist. Anticipate that they are going to resist. In the long run, it is going to be so much better for them. So I really see that a lot with this, particularly again with math, because there's so many holes in the bucket. It is a subject that builds on itself in a different way.
It is. And use that as a, hey, if you start doing better in your classes and the tutor agrees with me that you're doing better, then let's work towards that. So you don't have to have their support. And you'd be surprised how many kids are like motivated by that. Okay, I'm going to work really hard so I don't have to be here with Adrienne anymore. Mm-hmm. So, and that works for them. And then there's some who love the support so much, they don't really need us and they won't leave because they love having that support and that attention. So you've got two different kinds of kids. You'll find out which one you have relatively quick when it comes to tutoring.
So when you were talking about the levels, let's dive into that a little bit, because that seems like a really big core concept in your work.
Yeah. Where do you want to start with that? Because there's
so you said there were three levels. You said concrete, abstract, and something else.
Yeah, concrete, representational, abstract. So concrete, something you can touch. For example, if we were working on fractions and you were working with us, I would mail you what's called fraction tiles and pattern blocks. And those are like the hexagons and the trapezoids, those shapes that you see. A lot of fraction work can be done with that. and the student will have the same materials as me. And even though we work online, the kids are really good at this, just adjusting their camera to show me how they're working with them. And so we work systematically together on those fractions at a concrete level, talking about the names of the fractions and breaking down the language denominator. A lot of kids, numerator, denominator, auditorily sound a lot alike. So we have to really break both of those words down so that the student understands. So that's another important part about the concrete is we break that language down. So denominator has N-O-M in it. And we really highlight that part of it because it means to name. We're giving a name to this fraction. And for a lot of kids, it makes a lot of sense. If I have one apple and two apples, how many do I have? Three apples. If I have one dog and two dogs, how many do I have? You know, so that kind of build up and then saying I have one third and one third, how many do I have? Two thirds. They understand that naming structure after hearing you build that bridge auditorily, that they go together. So it means to name. And the numerator is the pieces, the parts that we have. So those kinds of exercises are really important, but we also pair it with that abstract. We write out the numbers at the same time so they can see how they relate. And like I said earlier, okay, these kids are really good at relationships. They can see that.
Okay, before you get into abstract, I want to define abstract. But before you even get into that, I just want to point something out. So what you're saying, I'm assuming for a lot of parents who this is new to, it's so much we can't cover all of it in this.
Yeah.
But one thing that I think is really, really important of what you're saying is that there are, within math vocabulary, it hints at more or less Latin roots that are in the words. So in other words, that there are parts of the math words that are indicating what the word is about. And I think a lot of teachers don't even know that themselves because they weren't trained. Mm-hmm. So you have a difference between math teachers who are teaching middle and high school and math teachers who are teaching elementary school that I think is very important to bring up. And that is that teachers who are trained for elementary school are trained a little bit in all subjects. And if they're somebody who geeks out about math, well, then they're going to be able to communicate that really well. Yeah. If they're someone who grew up and they're an elementary teacher, but they grew up saying, I'm bad at math, I'm not, you know, they're probably not taking the time on their own to geek out about math, do their own geeky research to find out weird things like the roots of words, which are so impactful. Yes. And what they tend to do is they tend to teach the how and not the why. Mm-hmm. Where, meaning they'll teach you how you do, for example, what's called the typical like multiplication algorithm, which might be like 35 times 78. And, you know, you multiply the 8 by the 5, then the 8 by the 3, and then you put your numbers here, and then you put your place. So, you know, and they teach how to do that process, but not why. And one thing that I've, this is just one example, and I want to go down this a little bit more, Adrian, before I finish this thought, but like, I'll ask adults, parents of my kids often, because this is fun for me, like, what is that seven? What are we really doing with that seven? That, and I'll say to the parents, that seven's not a seven. And it's not very common that a parent can pick up on what I'm implying. And then I say, that seven is a 70.
Yes.
Not multiplying seven, you're multiplying 70. And so, and it takes a while even for a lot of adults. So anyhow, your middle and high school teachers have trained to teach math, your middle, generally, your middle and high school math. Now you will get some that are teaching math that weren't, but generally speaking, your middle and high school teachers were trained to be math teachers. Your elementary teachers were trained to be general.
Yeah.
So that's very important because at these younger stages, when we're building these foundations, we have people who aren't trained unless they nerd out on themselves on it. They're not trained oftentimes to do this. Now, do they go to trainings with the district? Of course. You hear your third grade kids teacher say, oh, I had to go to a math training. We learned blah, blah, blah. But that's like a 2-day thing once in a while, and to basically it's red tape a lot of times. Mm-hmm. They learn stuff, sure, but are they given the foundation that they can then? I'm bringing this up to, I think it's important in this conference to really go there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to point out too that Jo Bowler proved, she found this correlation that teachers who have math anxiety themselves pass it on to their students. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, a lot of our teachers in the elementary years, they choose that because they feel like they can't do that higher level stuff. And my mentor recently went to a conference and sat down with the dean of education at this college who admitted most of the teachers coming out of college prep cannot pass a sixth grade math test. Mm. That's a problem. That's a problem that these teachers can't do the lower level stuff. So,
and this is not to put teachers down at all.
No, it's a societal issue. I get so passionate. Societal issue. We need, as a country, to embrace doing math this way. It's appropriate for all learners, not just kids with executive function, dyslexia, or autism. It's for everybody. Everyone would benefit from doing it this way. So I could just, you know, stand on the soapbox all day about that. But it's important if you're seeing these problems when they're younger, please don't do the wait and see approach. It's a bad idea. Get help now. We work with kids as young as third grade online, but I also know several other people that can go even younger. So feel free to email me. I'm a resourceful gal. I can find people for you. So it's important to not wait and see what happens. Mm-hmm. I lost my train of thought. Where were we going? We were talking about CRA.
I want to do another soapbox because I think you're the only person who's talking about this stuff. And I think it impacts these kids who struggle with executive function on so many levels. But I don't remember where the soapbox was that I was
working memory at its best.
Yeah, I've been writing a list of things. I do have a question that, for those watching, I know this is not a linear talk that we're doing right now, but I do think these are really important issues to go over with people. So we have this math instruction, and the reason I'm going to ask this for people watching is because they're trying to help their kids, and the reality is the system or the teachers, even if you're in a private school or a Montessori school or a public school, it doesn't matter if you think you're in a progressive school. You may still be dealing with these issues. So for the parent that's watching this and says, okay, I may have a teacher that really doesn't get this. It's not the teacher's fault. They're doing the best they can with what they have. But I want to make sure that the holes are filled in. So if you could change the way and this is a big question, but you don't have to go super deep with it. But if you could change, had a magic wand and could change the way math was taught, what would you change in our school systems and why? And the reason I'm asking this is so that parents watching can sort of apply it in their situation at least a little bit.
Okay, I daydream about this.
So I know that's a giant question.
Daydream about it.
Give them enough to have a thought where they can be like, oh, I can use that to sort of at least ask better questions. And
Yeah. So in the schools, what I would love is teachers are swamped. Part of why they go to these professional developments and they can't take what they learned and apply it in the classroom is because they're overwhelmed. They don't have enough time. So what I would love to do in the future, and I'm working on this, is provide them that training, that support, but also continued support. So they can leave and they have access to an online portal that's fast and easy for them. So if they come to school that day and they know, oh, I'm teaching fractions today, I can watch Adrienne's 5-minute video and walk away with a page I can print out with the correct language and examples and pictures of how to do it with my kids. Okay, I have more support than I had yesterday to teach that topic. That's my goal because teachers are limited. They don't have as much time on their hands to really master this method. And the best way for them to do it is to get the training, but then continued support in applying the method in the classroom. So I would love to see something like that where we're actively helping school districts train these teachers in the elementary years mostly. And then yes, I'm coming after middle school, high school too, because they should be using some of these things that the lower grades do for their high school students. Manipulatives in the high school classroom are completely appropriate. They should be used. And so part of it is they just don't know how, because most of them, A, were good at math growing up, but they mostly only know how to do
high school teachers.
Yeah, the middle and high school. they mostly only know how to do procedural steps. They teach you the how, not the why. And our kids crave the why. If I don't spend time teaching them the why, they're not very interested in what I'm talking about. So I would love to see that kind of change happen. And then in the colleges themselves, there should be several years where we're doing this kind of multi-sensory math with the teachers in training so that they come out feeling much more prepared to be with these kids and figure out what they need. That's the core issue, is that I feel like my undergrad did not teach me anything I'm doing right now. Mm-hmm. None of it. It was all abstract, not helpful. And everything I know today is because I went and learned it on my own. And that's unfortunate. The schools need colleges to give us teachers that are well prepared.
And who's the author, the person who you learn most of the stuff about multisensory from?
Yeah, her name is Marilyn Zecker. She works with a nonprofit called ASDEC, A-S-D-E-C. So look for her. She does two levels of training, multisensory one, multisensory two. So the first one goes up to fractions, then the second one goes all the way up to high school. It's an amazing class. It's hard though, parents, I'm telling you, if you take it or a teacher takes it, it's a lot of time. It's exhausting mentally because you're completely changing the way you talk about math.
It's excellent time for homeschool parents, do you think?
Yes, it can be. But also, again, I'm not going to Pollyanna the solution. It's going to take you several years to get to the point where you feel comfortable doing the method. I'm helping a homeschool group go through her class right now. And that is overwhelming to them to hear that it can take an hour or more to plan the lesson for your student.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Times that, times five kids if you're homeschooling. I mean, that's a lot of hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The good news is that it pays off in the long run.
It does. Because
their foundation is so solid that they can really
exactly.
do super, super high level math.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's not 2 years of like about really, really hard, you working hard with your kid, and then they have that solid foundation, much easier after that.
So another side road, but that I think is really important, that nobody has mentioned yet. Can you please mention what dyscalculia is, why we should know about it? Are you able to identify them because you're very intuitive at this point and you can just kind of tell the first time you meet a kid, or do you have a couple of questions or things? We don't have to go far down this, but people need to know that it even exists.
Okay, so dyscalculia is a math learning disability. And the thing that's interesting...
Often unidentified.
It's often unidentified or misdiagnosed, saying a kid does have it, but they don't. So let me tell you about that really quick. Often dyslexia affects math, and they might get a dyscalculia diagnosis, but it's really the dyslexia that is affecting the ability to do the math. Because if you think about math in itself, it has a lot of directionality to it, and it doesn't follow the rules all the time. Sometimes we're starting at the right, sometimes we're starting at the left, and you have to be good at that stuff, you know. And then the working memory issues, that's a common dyslexia problem. That's going to affect math. So sometimes our kids will get diagnosed with that. I'm not against that. I'm okay with that because at least in the school system, that means more support. So it's not bad that your kid got that diagnosis. I'm okay with it. Leave it alone. But true dyscalculia is a little bit different in that these kids really have a hard time wrapping their mind around quantity and magnitude, the size of it, how big something can be. They're terrible at time. They have no concept of time even. So an example of that would be, they know they have an appointment in the afternoon, but they wake up at 6 a.m. because they're not sure how long that time period is to 2, instead of just getting ready for the day at 1 or something like that for that appointment at 2. They wake up super early because they have no concept of time. And money's really hard, no concept of money and how that works. These kids struggle with number in a different way. However,
it's a true disability.
It's a true disability. If you want to read more about someone who has that, read the book called My 13th Winter. It's a memoir all about a woman who has dyscalculia. And it is heartbreaking to read it. It touched me deeply. A lot of my students struggle with the same thing she's talking about. And even as an adult to this day, panic rushes through her when she's at the checkout and she needs to count the cash out to what for what she needs. Even though she's been working on it, it's still hard for her. So it's not something that tons and tons of therapy is going to get rid of. There's things we can do to help, but there'll be moments when you really struggle with understanding what's going on.
But you, if your child is struggling with dyscalculia, you need to know that.
You need to know that. Yes, absolutely. And the way you get assessed for that, it's not like you can take a blood test, right? And like, oh, yep, you have dyscalculia. It's qualities. They're looking at the qualities of your child. And depending on what test they're using, again, you could either get the diagnosis or not. And that huge asterisk, it might be dyslexia that's affecting it. So if you go and get in a formal assessment too, if your child has a problem with reading or written expression or something along those lines and a math learning disability, it's most likely dyslexia affecting it. But if they don't really have any of those other things and it's math, that's true dyscalculia. But they also could be comorbid. It's complex, guys.
We don't
it's
have complex. To go down there, but I want them to know at least a little bit. Now, I know that we started with concrete and we're going to abstract and we haven't, but I will get back there. My working memory is holding that. But okay. I want to ask also a lot of my kids, well, all my kids are struggling with executive function. I do have some kids who are fantastic at math that struggle with executive function. And I have some kids that I know are good at math concepts and mathematical thinking, but they're failing usually one of two or a combination of two reasons. One, because they forget to turn in their work and then they're getting zeros and don't study and, you know, or don't do their homework. And so those are executive function issues. Or they don't show their work and they're stuck in this mindset of, I don't feel like showing my work. Mm-hmm. And then they miss one little detail, even though they can do some really complex stuff, and they get it wrong. Now, that's a different issue than not turning in your work at all. Like, these are the kids who won't show their work. So a lot of kids who struggle with executive function won't show their work. And a lot of what I'm doing is helping turn that corner to understand that, no, this will not kill you. Not only that, you'll probably actually enjoy math more. And, you know, once they sort of surrender to that, but I want you to speak to the not showing work piece.
Totally, totally. And a lot of these kids too, yes, they're mathematical thinkers. They're really good at arithmetic, but showing and communicating that thought process that happens so rapidly is painful for them. It feels like they're moving through the mud, right? Like, I can't do this. However, as they get older, the math gets more complex, and it's harder for them to see those relationships. So they have to rely on learning the procedure and step. So I did write down a classic problem, a classic trap, and the kids with executive function, they immediately think, oh, the answer is 5. Yep, the answer is 5. I know it's 5. No, it's not 5. And again, it's because they have to rely on learning the procedures and steps of how to isolate that variable. So we have to teach that to the kids. And that's hard for them because they feel like it's difficult.
Tell us what for those who forget how to do that.
Sure. Sure. Here, let me write it. Let me make more room because I wrote it kind of big so you guys could see it. So let me
write it. So it was again. X over 35 equals 7.
Yep. X over 35 equals.
And a fraction is a division problem.
Yep. Fractions are just division, and they have to first, these are my steps, this is my language that I use. I say, who's messing with my x? Oh, it's 35. 35's messing with my x. How are they messing with my x? Through division. What's the opposite of division? Multiplication. So I'm going to start right there, that step. This is the first thing I'm going to write, x over 35. I'm going to multiply by 35, okay? And this is okay to do too. All right, but I have to do it to both sides, guys. So I do it over here too. And now this here, if you don't remember, this is the quantity of 1. In our school days, they said it cancels out. We're not canceling anything. The reality is it's the quantity of 1. Any number written over itself is 1. So now we have just x equals 7 times 35. Another tip too, I'll show my kids. Sometimes they get lost with the numbers and where they are in their steps. And so I have them write a line in between that step. Mm-hmm. That was step 1. Here's step 2. And I'm going to multiply. And I'm going to show you guys the power of understanding.
You got to move over a little bit.
Yep. Understanding what a number is made of. I'm going to scoot it in.
Nice.
So I broke 35 into 30 times 5.
Nice.
Because it's easier to work with. So 7 times 30, well, I do this place value here, 21, the 0. Then I do 7 times 5 is 35. Okay. Then we can add them together. Okay, that was another step. I'm going to put a line. So we continue showing our steps and our thinking that way, and the students can see, oh, that was clearly step one. This was step two. And that's hard for our kids because it's slow. It feels so slow. It feels so painful. But it's really important for them to learn how to do this so that they can find out that the answer all along was 245, which they originally thought was 5 because they saw the relationship. But as they get older, those relationships are really hard to see. And they need to know and master those systematic steps, especially at the middle and high school level. When you're younger, you can move the numbers around quite a bit. But
right,
the older, it's memory, difficult.
That trick is, it's tricky because the working memory can handle a lot until like fifth grade or something.
And yes.
If they're really pretty strong with it, you know, great visual thinking and stuff, they might be able to really fake it for a while. With
a fifth long time. Grade.
But yes. It's too many details for
yes.
the working memory to handle.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's really important to show them, expect them to do their work. Now you can build up to this. Okay. So with my son, for him, his brain sees the relationship so fast. He can go so quickly. So for a while, there was a time where I was his scribe. He would just tell me what the steps were and I would write the steps down. And that was better for him for a short time. And I let his teacher know that I was performing a scribe. I promised that he was doing all the calculations. You know, she didn't have a problem with it. So that was helpful. And then we scaffold that out. And he.
I'm going to interrupt you. I'm glad you said scaffold. And I want parents to know that I do that a lot. You have to judge. I have to judge in the moment with a bunch of different students when I'm going to scaffold. And because sometimes that is the better thing in the best interest of the learning of the kid. So for those of you parents who are like, well, is this cheating? And just ask yourself the question, is this in the best interest of their learning? And because you can't learn everything at once. And remember what you're trying to do in any particular case. So go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So another kind of trick we do to get kids to show their work, you're going to like
this. Can I interrupt you again?
Can, yes. So
Adrienne's lines, I want you all to know that I do something similar. I have 3/4-inch graph paper that I make hundreds of copies of. So for these kiddos, often even high schoolers, I'll have them use this 3/4-inch graph paper and put the numbers in those boxes a few times, sometimes for a few weeks or months, but I want them used to the process. They will change their attitude about it eventually.
Yes.
Especially if I'm engaging with them there, we're having some fun and whatever, so that is sort of my take on how she did the lines, and I will put lines under it also. I'll also do a ice cream cone thing around most algebra stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm showing them how it step by step. So
and
I draw
down.
That on and I use the, I won't go into the,
oh,
and
I love that.
Thing I want to say before Adrienne says something is the way Adrienne just showed you that, I was enjoying watching her because I nerd out on this stuff. I would not have taught it the same, but the way she taught it was perfect and the way I would teach it is perfect. The reason I'm saying that is because you parents don't have to think, well, that's the right way? Adrienne's way? Oh, Seth's way is the right way? Oh, this image I saw on Facebook, that's the right way? And I've seen actually a lot of things on social media where parents are like, why are they teaching it this way nowadays? This is so confusing. But actually, when you see, when you understand what's actually going, the why, you're going to look at all different types of ways of doing the same thing, and they can all be right. It doesn't really matter. What we want for our kids is for them to be able to have the mathematical thinking to be able to approach it in many different ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really enjoyed watching your
absolutely method. And that's a perfect segue into this. So another thing to encourage kids to write down their thinking is to give them a problem like this. And give them the answer. Here's the answer. Here's the problem. I want you to show me 5 different ways to solve that. Because guess what? It's more than just a traditional long division. So the kid could break it up into 300 plus 90 plus 7 and divide it, or they could do 300 plus 50 plus 40 plus 7. They could go even smaller. There's so many ways for them to show you their why, how it works, and have the answer. So I love that too, because it allows them to show their thinking of how they got there, and then have the kids share with each other, if this is for teachers, share with each other how you solved this problem and see who could come up with some of the most unique ways and celebrate that fun part of being a mathematician. It's not just calculating all the time, guys. It's about finding the beauty in math, in thinking. Yeah. Finding a pattern, breaking down the numbers, exploring that, questioning your answers. It's so much fun.
I'm so glad that you used that example too, because we adults watching have to unlearn this idea that it's about getting the right answer. And you just showed a problem where you gave the right answer. So then parents or teachers can be like, well, then how am I going to grade that? Well, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have, I don't believe in grades anyway, but they exist. But like, I don't care if this kid showed me five different ways and three of them were even wrong or didn't work. Right. I don't care. Right. I care that they, and I don't want them to feel like, oh, three of mine didn't work. I want them to be like, I tried five ways, my effort, like I practiced a bunch of different ways and like, this is so cool. I found two that worked. Oh, well, I found five that worked. Cool.
Exactly. Share it with us.
Our tone around the right answer and how we're teaching. Like, I'm so much of what we're doing is we're teaching the process of thinking. We're not teaching about the right answer. It's how do you
exactly think? How do you think? And let's communicate about your thinking process, which is so valued in this world, right?
That too.
So I love that's, you can learn those skills through math and by giving those kids the answers. Oh man, just it relieves all of that pressure for answer getting and puts all the focus on your thinking. And that's what I want for my kids. So the other thing too, we didn't get to talk about the representational part. That's the imagery. That's the drawing pictures.
So we start with concrete, representational, abstract.
Yes.
So the concrete is very very hands-on or very visual, using manipulatives. It is very symbolic, rather than just memorizing numbers and everything. It's experiential, where you're concretely experiencing math by moving things or doing things. Is that a good way to describe it?
Totally good way to describe it. Representational is about drawing that picture. So it's not always appropriate to like lug around all these things, you know, for manipulative. So kids need to see how you do it pictorially as well. So it could be doing fractions with a bar model, which you're probably seeing more at school, and learning how to explain your thinking. And again, it boils down to really important language when we're talking about math, and being slow in your language is important too. If you ever get to sit in and watch me tutor, I speak quite slowly. There's a lot of pauses. I'll count to five sometimes while I wait for that kid to think, to give them time to process and hear what was said. So the representational is huge. For the sake of time, I'm just gonna let Seth link to my YouTube channel. There's tons of videos over there where you can look at examples of that. My favorite one was about customary units lately. Most teachers like to teach it with gallon man. It doesn't make sense to me to do it that way, so I teach it representationally and show how we break up the parts, and again, show you how the language ties in. But what a pint is, you probably don't know this, but a pint in Old English means the mark. And that was basically what a dude did, painted a mark, and then poured up whatever liquid to the pint. And that was the mark. So, and pint came from the word paint. So that kind of stuff, it's important to talk about that with your kids because it has more meaning about the why. We have a weird measurement system in the United States. Kids want to know why that is. So that's really important. Then the abstract is just the numbers.
Can
just
I
the
say
numbers.
Something again?
Yeah.
Before we get an abstract. So
sure.
I don't know what the gallon dude is.
You haven't heard of the gallon dude?
No, but I don't know if I want to know or not. but what I want to know, or what I want to say is that if the gallon dude is kind of popular right now, he's not going to be forever.
Yeah.
And so for the teachers that are going to a couple of trainings, learning about the gallon dude, everybody's talking about the gallon dude. In a year or two or three, a curriculum manufacturer is going to say, this is the new end all be all, and this is what we're going to do. And we're going to do everyday math, or we're going to do,
I
can't list off all the different ones now. So don't worry, parents, about, again, the right way. I think a lot of teachers are learning that a method right now, but a new one will come, and then a new one, and then a new one, and it might be different from district to district anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But what you want to do as a parent who's watching this is not watch like one YouTube video on like a thing, but like watch a bunch of different people teach the same thing. You're going to get, the better you can communicate about math with your kid, you will learn. I will tell you this, because Adrian and I both got way better at this once we started learning more and more and more about it. So there are many, many, many ways to problem solve. You, the parent watching, don't look for the way.
Yeah.
Look for understanding what the whys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Instead
absolutely.
Of certain hows that we latch on to.
Yes, yes. Gallon Man isn't my favorite, mostly because they say man, so a lot of my students are like, by the time you get down to the ounces on the ends, which is his fingers, there's only four there, and it's confusing because the kid wants to say there's five because that's how many fingers I have on my hands. So that's my argument for that, is it can be confusing for some kids. Instead, teach the relationship between the measurements. So with that, we should talk about the abstract, which is just the numbers, which is where most of the teaching happens that your kids are exposed to now. And it's not that it's bad. That is the end goal. It's efficient. It's around for a reason. So our goal is to spend time with concrete representational, with the end goal of heading to abstract, because that's much more efficient. You're not going to lug around a bunch of craft sticks, which is what we use for place value. You're not going to lug those around to help you calculate. You will want to have a piece of paper or be able to do it in your head. And that's where the abstract comes in. So we actually teach all three of those simultaneously in and together. We don't teach concrete one day.
It's not a step by step. It's more of a spiral.
Yeah, together. It's not like I do concrete this day, representational this day, abstract this day. No, they happen together. We do concrete a couple times, then we add in the picture, and we can add in the abstract all at the same time. And that does not confuse the student. It helps them see multiple ways of viewing the same problem.
Which is what we want.
That's what we want.
Not memorizing the algorithm.
Exactly, exactly. And then the other thing I thought would be helpful for everyone listening is just talking about the homework drama that can wrap around math. A couple of things happen. A, you didn't learn doing it this way. B, you're probably doing it wrong. That's what your kids are saying. You're doing it wrong, Mom. The teacher won't accept it, blah, blah, blah. It's okay. Take a deep breath. The first thing about homework, doing it with your kid, keep your emotions in check. And strive to have a neutral face, because there's research that shows kids starting around the age of 11 lose the ability to read facial expressions correctly. Unless you're extremely happy, they think everything else means you're mad, which is why we explode at each other so much, because they're misunderstanding you. Mm-hmm. So if you can strive to have kind of a more neutral face when you're working on homework with your child, and sit shoulder to shoulder, not like a look me in the eyes when I'm talking to you kind of thing, shoulder to shoulder, talking neutrally about the math, it's going to be a much better experience than if they can see all of the expressions on your face, from frustration because you can't remember how to do it, which will be read as anger, or confusion because you can't remember how to do it and they think you're mad. It just will change the whole homework dynamic. And the other thing I'd recommend too, I don't like it when teachers do this, but I understand it's convenient for them. They'll send home huge homework packets at the beginning of the week, and they feel overwhelming for kids with executive function. So don't feel bad. You're going to rip it apart. You're going to do one at a time, one per day, and turn it in at the end of the week. And don't worry about it. Your kid might balk at first. I know mine did. Like, you're breaking the rules. You're blah, blah, blah. It's fine. It's not a big deal. Chunk it down. Make it doable. Set a timer. And the other thing too, if you can find time to do some sort of math warm-up with your child before, some sort of fun game, it helps lower the anxiety and also turns on those parts of their brain that need to be used for the homework.
So for kids that are at lower levels of math, younger kids with me, I'll do a warm-up. Older kids, I don't really do a warm-up. Like my juniors and seniors, I don't really do that. But a warm-up can be as simple as mental math. Let's do 72 plus 132.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and you can do two and they do two. It's just getting the brain going, you know.
Exactly.
Obviously,
it's practicing and flexing that working memory, right? I love the mental math example. And you can use hand gestures to help them hold it. You know, I'm adding 70 and 12. 70, mm-hmm. 70, 70, 12. What's 12 made of? 1, 10, 2, 1. Mm-hmm. What's 70 and 10, right? So using some hand gestures can also help them hold mm-hmm. and manipulate because they're visual. So they're doing it visually. And so that having some hand gestures can really help too.
Mm-hmm.
I could talk all day about this, Seth. I'm having fun.
Yeah. So a warm-up is sometimes I'll do just because I think it's really practical. Sometimes I'll do one problem warm-up, but I know that it's about what we're about to be doing in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I give them one that's super easy in that way. And then in the warm-up, I might have them explaining it to me. Now, the other thing I want to say about if you're doing homework with your kid is I'm not doing much talking. I'm the thing that I want to tell them, I ask.
Mm-hmm.
So I notice that there might be, I might say to them, if we're doing a division problem, for example, one thing I do with the long division algorithm that you showed before, a lot of times, one thing that I'll do is I'll say, okay, we're starting. What's the very first thing I want you to do? And depending on that, one of the things I often have them do if they're have enough skill in it is to put the decimal point there first. So I have them add the one above the line and at the end of it so that it's lined up. Or I might have them, if I'm helping them figure out where to put the numbers in the right place, I might have them put the lines on first and I'll say, what's the first thing I want you to do? You know? And they'll say, put the decimal there. I'll be like, yes, do it. Or I won't say, yes, do it. I'll be like, I don't say a lot. And then I say, what's the second thing? Put an mm-hmm. addition sign on the next line. Now, again, Adrian might not do it the way that I'm doing it. Doesn't matter. They know my expectation and how I'm leading them through, in this case, a process. But so I'm not doing a lot of talking. I'm doing a lot of asking.
Yes.
And leading.
Yeah. And
if,
so
if something's wrong, I don't, or here's one of my favorites too. If a kid says, is that right? What's your response to that, Adrian? If they say, is that right?
I'll say, prove it to me.
Okay. I say, what do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. Prove it to me. What do you think? Check it. And
what do we often do? Yeah, it's right. No, it's wrong. Stop. Like, we want them to think.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's right. Yeah. Or I might say that. I don't care
if it's right. I don't care if it's right. What do you think? Yeah. Yeah. And my students get better and better at that. They get quicker if checking their work instead of my validation. They're like, oh yep, that checks out, it looks like it
and
works.
That's what we want. We don't want the right answer, we want them self-checking.
I love that you're, what are you starting with? We use cueing phrases, so going back to that division problem, I'll say who, how, what, you know, what, opposite. That's all I have to say if they're struggling to remember the steps and they're, oh yeah, do it to both sides. Oh, got that. You know, so just having cueing phrases even too, or even a simple mm-hmm. gesture, but you're right. Like, you're not talking a whole lot.
The first thing I have them almost always do also is read the question to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or the directions at the top. None of my students read. None of them read it.
Mm-hmm.
And I admit too, I'm like, I typically do that too, but I have to slow my brain down and say, oh, I probably should go read that and see what they're really wanting me to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely, definitely hard.
So you said we want to get to abstract. Essentially, what I hear you saying is that the representative and the concrete, we almost want to be so far beyond those that we don't even really think in that. Like, the end goal is where we can work in the abstract zone.
Yeah, we can work in the abstract, but we also have those imagery to tie from.
Right.
So an example of that would be
the foundation.
It's the foundation. So if I'm an algebra student and I'm factoring, that is the same kind of activity. I'm glad I brought my whiteboard, Seth.
Me too.
Factoring is the same kind of activity as, let me see if I do it right. Same kind of concept as, here's the area. What are the side lengths? What are some optional side lengths for that? Or if they gave us a number like this, oh, what's the other side length? Okay, so that's what factoring's like. It's like this elementary skill, and they will have this to pull from. And if they're struggling with the idea of factoring, we go back. We can revisit this really quickly at the lower levels and then jump back up to where we were, and it makes a whole lot more sense. Oh, I'm finding the sides of a rectangle. Oh, okay, I can do that. And it makes it a lot less overwhelming. So I love the concrete and representational for that reason. It gives lots of things they can pull from and things to relate to at the abstract.
So let's just do a couple more thoughts and tie this into executive function and wrap up.
Okay.
So you had mentioned working memory before. And one of the things, and I haven't spoken with anybody about this because we've been doing, you're the only math expert that we're speaking to, but one of the things that you often hear with working memory, which is a part of executive function, is that we can remember 5 to 9 digits in our working memory at a time. It's such a common thing that we hear. So I just want to sort of tie that in, and because you're talking about working memory, and that could be the mental math. If I said, what's 172 plus 33 in working memory, I just want people to walk away really knowing what working memory is. 172 plus 33 means that I remember that it's addition. I remember that it's a 30, it's a 3, it's a 3, it's a 70, it's a 100. I know that I can add 100. 70 and a 30 is 100. 3 and a 3 is a 6. So 206, you know. So I'm, with working memory, we're holding these things. And when you were showing the process from line to line, they're having to remember. So can you talk a little bit more about working memory and how it shows up in some common math ways, or is that good?
No, I think, I think the math fact one is the most common that's going to affect the kid in the long term. So the ability to hold those numbers and work with them is going to cause a lot of problems. So, as far as like solving that problem, it's having what I call a near point reference, something they can look at, not a calculator, but maybe if you're like, working with problems that have the sevens times table, you would write out the sevens times table really quick to lower that need for your brain to use, to have to go find and use and manipulate. Just write it down really quick one time. Like you've been doing in this interview, you write your notes down, right? So teaching the kids to be cognizant of their brain wiring, that working memory is a little weak. So I'm going to take the time right now to write down my sevens times table so that I don't have to work so hard later. Kids like that. If you set it up like that for them, oh, that's why I would do that. Not because you're torturing me.
Right.
No, it's because we want to support your brain. So that kind of stuff can be really helpful. Quick little note cards. You could actually advocate for those kinds of things in their IEP to be used during a test. It's not that they're explicitly writing out necessarily equations or whatever, but it's something that they can use to trigger that working memory to hold and remember some piece of information they needed. So there's that piece of it. But I like the math fact. That one's the one most parents can relate to. Any other ones, I don't know that they're necessarily worth chatting about today.
And are there other parts of executive function that you haven't mentioned that you want to that are super important with math?
The flexible thinking. Flexible thinking. So that problem I showed you earlier where we give the answer.
Great example. Yeah.
That's flexible thinking. A fun way.
Flexible thinking.
So it's the ability to see the numbers in different ways in different relationships.
And what's the opposite of flexible thinking that's problematic with math class?
Here's a young example. We get kids rigidly thinking that the only way to make 10 is 5 and 5. That's it. And they really struggle with seeing that, well, I could make it into 3 and 7, okay? And teachers typically only teach the whole number relationships, but we could teach kids to think of it this way. On the spot math, I'm kind of worried here, Seth. Okay, this is also a 10. Okay. I can combine these two together and I make another one, and that would make this 3, and 3 plus 7 is 10. So that is flexible thinking. We want kids to start thinking this way. There are so many ways we can make 10, way more than just the add-ins, the regular ones, the whole numbers. That's where most teachers stop. But we want to start teaching this kind of thinking too.
So is there one easy way that a parent can add in a tiny bit more flexible thinking?
Absolutely. So this would be a fun warm-up game. Any age a kid can do it. The one that I'm thinking of is called Pyramid Solitaire. Look it up online. It's a deck of cards, regular playing cards. The first level, you could take out all the face cards, the Jack, the Queen, and the King. And the goal would be just to add within 10. And so look up those directions. The second level would be to add to 13, which is a difficult number to add to. You'd be surprised how many kids really are like, oh, this is hard. I can't use more than 3 cards because their goal in their mind is I'm going to make 10 and then 3. No, I want you to add to 13. So what I like about it from a working memory issue and flexible thinking too, is they're having to search these rows of cards and they're holding a number. They're going, okay, 6, 6 plus, they might be counting on their fingers. 6 plus what? Oh, I need a 7. 6 plus 7, 6 plus 7. And they're saying it over and over and over in their head while they're hunting for that 13 to pair it and move it to the side. So when my kids start playing that game, it's kind of funny. They swap from I'm always adding to 10 to, oh, I see this quantity of 13. And, oh, there's a 7 over here. Look, I made 20. So I like that game in that it teaches them to be very flexible thinkers.
Cool. And you said working memory, flexibility. Is there one other?
There was one more, like in my notes.
Organization.
Self-control. So the self-control about your emotions and task initiation, that kind of stuff. So let me tell you the story about Brittany, one of my students. She's amazing. She came to me when she was finishing out her last year of middle school. Math was hard. She was failing a lot. And it was difficult. There was a lot of big emotions around that failure. But what she learned from working with me is that failure is the path to learning. That failure is just feedback. And there's nothing wrong with that feedback. And thankfully, I love this about her school. There was no rule that said she couldn't take that test again and again and again. She could take it as many times as she wanted. So Brittany turned it into a game. She would flunk a test, call me. Oh, I flunked this test. And I'm like, gosh, well, that's great feedback. Let's look and see what happened. Never failed. It was always something like, oh, you added instead of subtracted. Or here you added differently. It wasn't that she didn't understand procedure. She did. And so having that feedback session for her was really important. And she got better at self-checking and accepting that failure is part of the learning process. She became failure tolerant. And that student, it was so fun to watch her over the last few years just blossom into this amazing math student who now confidently will walk up to the front of the room and show a completely different way of doing it and surprise her own teachers. They're so shocked. They think, well, I've never thought of doing it that way, but it works. You just proved it to me. So she's one of those kids that doesn't need us anymore, but she stays because she likes having that fallback, that feedback session, and that support. So that's what's possible with teaching your kids to be learn to manage their emotions and change their frame of reference for failure. Because failures, there's feelings around it, and they only have power if you give them power. So we can talk about it's disappointing, but at the end of the day, it's just feedback. It doesn't mean you're bad at math. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It's just feedback that you missed just small things.
And I think that that's the thing that we're dealing with kids like this is a lot. So thanks for saying that too, is that they internalize it and they think I'm bad at math. And we don't think of this as an emotional issue, but thinking I'm bad at something feels bad. So what do? Shut down. How do they do it? Many different ways. They will do anything and everything they can do to avoid, procrastinate, tell you, stop bugging me, leave me alone. Why are you doing this? How come you never trust me? I'm just bad at math. I don't care. When am I ever going to use this anyway? This is stupid. So they have so many ways, but that's a response to feeling. And what we've talked about with a lot of the people on the summit is emotions in general. But one thing to do at that point is notice what's happening with their body. Like, I'm bad at math. Be like, oh, I noticed your shoulders went up when you said you're bad at math and your voice changed. Yeah, well, blah, blah, blah. A lot of times I ask kids, when was the first time you ever felt bad at math? And yeah, they'll remember. They'll be like, second grade, my teacher yelled at me when I did blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, it's so interesting to bring them back to that. You and I could go on for hours.
We could go on for hours. It's so fun to talk about this. But at the end of the day, I think it's really important when your child does fail, you need to communicate that you're not disappointed with them, you know, enforce that it's feedback. Let's look at it together instead of enforcing it's a shameful thing. Oh, he failed again, and don't even talk about it. Talk about it. Be vulnerable, go there with your kid, and see if you can uncover some of the mistakes that were made, because it only can get better if they're aware of the mistakes. That's where the learning happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. And that executive function wise, so much of what you said is tied into so many other things. I mean, that ties into reflection and introspection and self-awareness and mindfulness, which
all of that
reflectiveness, they're all kind of so. Cool. All right. I think we're good, Adrienne. Let me ask you my last two questions.
Okay.
The second to last question is this. Parents watching this right now, they're really concerned. They really want to help their kid. In the next week, what's one thing they can do to implement some of your teachings?
Yeah. Easy implement would be to be with your kid as they're doing their homework. Don't sit across the table, sit next to them so that you can avoid that miscommunication on your faces. That's super easy. You could do that tonight. And then I would say, again, like break down the homework into sizable chunks and even take a piece of paper and cover most of it. Some of our kids want to just rapidly like look through that paper. Encourage them to cover it. We're just doing one problem at a time. So those are some easy things that you can do. And then again, with that feedback piece, being vulnerable with your kid and going there if they're failing or getting lower grades. And then the final thing is don't wait to get help. If you and your kid are going like this, it's going to be hard. Mm-hmm. Hire some outside help. I don't care if it's me. Just find someone that cares about kids that can help your child. Having that neutral party enter in and start helping is going to be a tremendous relief. And so don't wait. Let's not do the wait and fail approach. Let's be proactive here with our kids. If the school year's coming up, don't wait for that first semester grade to come. Let's do something about it right now.
And if they want to subscribe, is it Math for Middles?
Yeah. Mathformiddles.com.
And yep. Then your YouTube channel is called?
Math for Middles.
Okay. So you can hop on the YouTube channel. If you click subscribe on the left-hand side, I use YouTube a lot, but on the left-hand side, she'll be in your subscriptions and you can always find her easily. That's how I find people easily that
I subscribe. Absolutely. Send me questions too. If you have specific questions, I do a new video every Tuesday starting in September all the way to about April. And then I take a break from doing YouTube, but I would be happy to answer any question you have for me and show you the multi-sensory way of solving that problem.
And the last question is this. So this one's a little bit different. From your heart, straight to the parent's heart who's watching this, who's really concerned, what is the most important takeaway you hope people leave with right now?
Oh, let's see. Honestly, I want parents to know if your child's been failing at math for a while, it's okay. Because here's what I've learned. It's never too late. I still help adults to this day with math. It's never too late to learn the math. So you haven't messed up. If you haven't gotten them help, it's never too late to start that conversation. Even if you wait until April of the school year, it's still not too late to get help. To have that child finish strongly. And I want you to feel okay about maybe you're not good at math. Maybe it hasn't gone well for you and that's okay. It's not your fault. The person, if we're going to blame anyone, would be our educational system. They're not keen on teaching to your wired brain. And that is our goal, is to figure out how your child learns, how you learn, and we tailor it to how your brain is wired. That's how education really should be. So it's okay that you didn't really have a stellar experience. And I'm glad you're here with us. It says a lot about you as a parent that you're here, that you're taking time to learn about this stuff. I can tell you're proactive already, and I think you're going to have a tremendous school year because you're here right now with Seth. So thank you for doing your part.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much, Adrienne.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. All right, yeah. Parents, go take action. I hope you parents have a nice day. We'll see you in the next session.